And the metaphor for talking about sunstone comes from a song of the 40s. It has to do with a young man that has a girlfriend who is so ample that he cannot hug the whole girl at one time. So he spends his Saturday night hugging and then making a mark with chalk and moving around. He spends his Saturday nights hugging and a chalking. And all goes well until he meets another guy coming around the other way. Mormonism is that girl. And whichever way we're going, we are the ones who are a hugging and a chalking, because we like to talk about Mormonism. We like to talk about the questions that it raises and the kinds of things that it tells us about our lives. And we can't grasp it all at one time. Several years ago, a cousin of mine, who is not a member of the church, sent a book to me. And she said, "Will you read this and tell me what's going on?" It was the book called Secret Ceremonies. Do any of you remember this? Yeah. I think the author was Deborah... Yes. Mm-hmm. And I approached it with a prejudiced attitude, because, first of all, she had been talking very cavalierly in public about temple ceremonies, and this is always kind of graded on my sensitivities. But she had also been on the Phil Donahue show. And anyone who has been on the Phil Donahue show is automatically suspect. But as I read the book, I saw something emerging. I saw a picture of a part of Mormonism. She was born into a well-to-do family in Florida. She had grown up in a not atypical Mormon experience. That is, she had been taught to respect those who told her what to do, and as a result showed up at BYU driving a very nice car, and simply assumed that what she was going to meet was what people had told her was going to be. It turned out to be not that way. My reaction during the reading of the book was, isn't it a shame that she didn't get an education? Isn't it a shame? Well, that doesn't mean that she was not intelligent, that she didn't go to classes. Her grade point average was enough to get her into journalism school at Northwestern after she graduated. But she had gone through the 4 years and had not gotten an education. One does not get an education, I believe, until one comes into the possession of one's own mind, till one discovers that one has a mind and that it has certain autonomous capabilities that cannot be ceded to anything or anybody else. Cardinal Newman said, education is thought, is exercised upon knowledge. And this, I think, is what had happened. Now, I will say that this is not a that this is not limited to BYU. I have seen the same picture at the University of Arizona, at Duke University, at the University of Minnesota, the University of Colorado. I think it is a picture of what happens in our national life, that people go through 4 years of university and come out with essentially an interesting social experience. Now, back to ride around the covered wagons one more time. This leads me to think about a certain passage in the book of Amos. The days are coming, declares the Lord God, that I will bring a famine in the land, not a famine of food, nor a thirst of water, but a famine of hearing the words of the Lord. Men will stagger from sea to sea and wander from north to east, searching for the word of the Lord, and will not find it. Now, why will they not find it? This leads me to another part where, riding around the covered wagons yet a third time now, we get to the point of attack, which is the story of Jacob. Jacob had led a checkered existence ever since his life in the womb. Rebecca reported that she felt that the twins in her womb were already fighting with each other. And when Esau got to the finish line first, when Jacob came out of the womb, he was already grasping at the heel of Esau, which is also an idiom for deception. And they grew up this way. Jacob, I think, led an anxious existence, always in the shadow of his brother who has the birthright, and by cunning and culinary skills, he gets Esau to sell him his birthright. And I don't know how seriously Esau took that. Jacob took it very seriously. And Rebecca favored Jacob, and when it came time to give the blessing, by deception, Jacob got his father Isaac, who was old and doddering and blind, to give him the birthright. And when all of this became known, it seemed good to Jacob to get out of town, which he did for 20 years. He went back to the land of his progenitors, and there he married and married and married and married, and he prospered, again, by rather sharp and sometimes questionable business practices, but he established himself as a household, 11 sons, 4 wives, and large flocks. He's coming back home. He gets the word that Esau is going to meet him with 400 men. Oops. How to do this one? Jacob sends his families across the river, his flocks and everything across the river, sends great gifts in Esau's direction, and then he remains behind. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. And the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go except you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." And he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Now, if we ask, why do not people find the word of the Lord, that is, the word that comes to us in times of our genuine need, commanding duties, showing redemption, showing or speaking with that voice that says, this is the way, walk ye in it. Why don't we find or hear that voice? I think it's because we don't approach the word of the Lord the way that Jacob wrestled with the angel. The word of the Lord is such that it cannot be served up in pre-digested capsules. If there is any time in our lives when we come to that point where we sense that we have the way of the Lord opening up to us, it is because we have spent the night wrestling. And this for me has become the metaphor for reading the Old Testament. It is the occasion. The encounter with the Old Testament can leave us with the sense that we have seen God face to face, and on the other hand, it can leave us with a merely dislocated hip. I'd like to tell you about my first wrestle with the Old Testament. It was in 1965. I was living in Tucson, Arizona, and I'd started to teach the gospel doctrine class. It was on the Old Testament. I came to the class knowing the stories that we hear in Sunday school and knowing the proof texts that we learn as missionaries, which is to say that I was worse than virginal with regard to the Old Testament. One of the first lessons had to do with Cain. 1965, remember. In the manual was this interpretation of the story of Cain, that the Negroes were cursed as to the priesthood because they were the descendants of Cain. What do you do with that? I just spent 2 years in the South, where for the first time in my life I saw that this was a pernicious thing. And I sensed in my gut that if I wanted to destroy someone psychologically, I could do no better than to get him to believe that he was under a curse imposed by God and by which he could, by no act, remove. Well, this is wrestling then with an interpretation of the Old Testament. It occurred to me in pondering this that one of the reasons given for this was that murder was such a horrible thing that to mark this, the Lord cursed the descendants of the first murderer. But if we read further in Genesis, we find that among the sons of Jacob, Levi was also a murderer, and his descendants were the only ones who could hold the priesthood. Well, how do we go about interpreting this? We believe that men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression. Can we at the same time say, in with regard to this interpretive context, that 400, 500 million men will be cursed for Cain's transgression and not for their own doing. And so on and so on and so on. It was a genuine wrestle because the outcome was significant. There were some interesting conversations that went on with the class, but even more interesting with the bishopric, who wanted to know how long this thing was going to go on. And one of the things which was urged by a member of the bishopric, saying, look, you've got in your class Reed C.V. He hasn't been in the church for 30 years, and he started to come back to church, and something like this, if you press this kind of thing, will just throw him right out again. It's too strong for him. Well, it turned out that into the material of the course, Reed C.V. went every Saturday afternoon to the public library to study the interpreter's Bible as it pertained to the material of the class. That for the first time in his life, he had found something of substance in the church. That there was something significant going on here. The ones who were shaken were the ones who had built their faith on an icon, on a picture of what the church ought to be. And when I made the statement that that Brigham Young, in two or three of his statements on racial matters, was wrong, this went down hard for those who had to have an infallible prophet at all times in the church. But for others who were willing to get into the wrestle and to join the issues, it was a new time. And after the first lesson on Cain, there were three of them, coming out of the class, a couple came up to me and said, I feel like we have rejoined the human race. You never know what is going to happen when you get involved in the wrestle because the outcome is not known. Well, what are the kinds of things that we wrestle with in reading the Old Testament? One of the interesting things is to define what it is that we are studying. When we say the Old Testament, we presuppose, don't we, that there is a New Testament. That the Old Testament by itself is not complete. But now suppose we look at this through the spectacles of an observant Jew. There is no New Testament. There is the Hebrew Bible. And it has its own integrity. And it is complete in itself. Now, if we look at the organization of the Hebrew Bible and try to see this through Jewish eyes, what do we find? It is not organized the same way as the Old Testament. I go through the Old Testament. We learned the names of these in seminary. And there's the first five books, and then there's Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, there's the historical books, and then there's something called the wisdom literature, and then there are the major prophets and the minor prophets. And that wraps it up. It's not the way it goes in the Hebrew Bible. There is the Pentateuch, and there's the Deuteronomistic history. And all of this came into existence in exilic or post-exilic times. This is the time that the Hebrew Bible emerged into essentially its present form. Now, what is the Deuteronomistic history? It is the answer to the question, what went wrong? Because from the point of view of the Hebrew Bible, the big event is not Genesis. The main event is the Exodus and the giving of the law and the establishing of the covenant. And everything else turns around that. Now, if we are coming back to Jerusalem after the exile in Babylon, why did all of this crumble? It was because people did not observe the law. And we see in the book of Deuteronomy, chapters 28 through the end, that Moses says, I set before you this day blessings and cursings. And these are the blessings. And he names them. And if you heed the words which I give, and if you keep the law which I give, you will get blessings. If you don't keep it, you'll get cursings. And that's the way the world is. Well, that does give an answer, doesn't it? What went wrong? People didn't keep the law. What does it do today? Ask Ezra after the exile. Well, he wants us to separate. He wants us to observe the law very strictly and keep ourselves from the other nations. And this leads to rabbinic Judaism over the course of centuries. Well, what else is in the Hebrew Bible? Why, you have a universalist current that has its headwaters back in the law about dealings with other nations. But then through the prophets, you start to get the idea that God is not simply the God of Israel, but is the God of the whole world. This was a new idea for a lot of folks. And that there is a universal mission of salvation that is implied in being of the house of Israel. This, by and large, is the stream to which Jesus responded. If you read in the New Testament, the times when he quotes the scripture, it's time after time after time, he quotes Isaiah and this universalizing theme. Now, one more point on this. Ezra, in order to keep the Jews, this is the beginning of Judaism, keep them separate, he calls together all the people, and those who have not been in exile have married foreign wives and had children by them. And he says, if you want to be numbered among the people of Israel, cast off your wives, cast off your children. You have sinned grievously in marrying them. Didn't matter if they wanted to convert. They were foreign. They were pushed out. Now, I can't help but wonder, and this is just a wondering, if someone there in that meeting didn't ponder this and go home and write the book of Ruth, which showed that King David was a descendant of one of these foreign women. And if someone else didn't go home and write the book of Jonah, where we find the story of Jonah the Hebrew, who is sent on an errand to the great city of Nineveh, the wicked city of Nineveh, so wicked that its wickedness has come up before the Lord and it's going to be destroyed. And the first thing that Jonah does is to get out of town. He tries to go someplace where God is not. He is going to go to the ends of the earth where God is not. He gets on the ship, and he goes to sleep, and the storm comes up. The mariners, each one prays to his own god, and nothing happens. They wake up Jonah and say, by the way, who is your god? Wake up and pray to him. Help save us. Well, says Jonah, I believe in the God that made heavens and the heavens and the earth and everything in them. Well, what do we say about a guy like that, who believes in a universal God and is trying to go someplace where God is not? Jonah has a moment of recognition. He says, I am the man. Throw me overboard. They do. And Jonah, who was trying to go someplace where God is not, now feels that maybe he has. The second chapter, out of the depths I have cried to thee. Third act, the fish coughs him up, and he goes on to Jonah. The fish, by the way, if we read in Jeremiah, is there's a passage that gives the image of Israel being swallowed up by a monster of the deep and then brought back up. Anyone reading it in that context would see some analogy, I think. He goes to Nineveh, and lo and behold, the Ninevehites, in spite of their wickedness, they turn to the Lord and they repent in sackcloth and ashes. And then Jonah goes up on the hill to see what's going to happen. And the Lord is very kind to him. He appoints a gourd, a plant that grows up very quickly, and it gives him shade that, so that he will be comfortable while he is watching the destruction of the city. Then God appoints a worm that gnaws around the roots, and the gourd withers. And Jonah becomes wroth. And God says to him, doest thou well to be angry? Yea, I do well to be angry even unto death. Because I knew what you were going to do. I knew that you're a merciful God. And as soon as these people repented, that you would change your mind. And here I'm looking like a fool. I've told them they're going to be destroyed. And then God asked the question, you were grateful for the gourd, which came in a day and withered in a day. Should not I be mindful of this great city in which there are 500,000 people who don't know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle, all of the animal creation? There's this stream also coexisting with the Deuteronomistic history, where if you do right, you will be blessed. If you do wrong, you will suffer. Now, what else is there? There's the wisdom literature. Now, what is the wisdom literature? The wisdom literature starts to flourish about the time of Solomon, and in my view, it is simply the discovery of the natural world. That which we can say about the world simply by opening our eyes and believing them. And what do we find there? We find the book of Job. Well, if there is ever anything which stands in contradiction with Deuteronomy, it's Job. Because he is the perfect man. He has done everything that he is supposed to. He hasn't done anything that he isn't supposed to. And yet he suffers. How do you square this with the idea of God? Can you hold the same idea of God? We start to see that there is a